This is Audible.
Books on Tape presents Red Storm Rising by Tom Clancy. Read by Michael Pritchard. Preliminary quotation. From time immemorial, the purpose of a navy has been to influence, and sometimes decide, issues on land. This was so with the Greeks of antiquity. The Romans, who created a navy to defeat Carthage. The Spanish, whose armada tried and failed to conquer England, and most eminently in the Atlantic and Pacific during two world wars. The sea has always given man inexpensive transport and ease of communication over long distances. It has also provided concealment, because being over the horizon meant being out of sight and effectively beyond reach. The sea has supplied mobility, capability, and support throughout Western history. And those failing in the sea power test, notably Alexander, Napoleon, and Hitler, also failed the longevity one. Edward L. Beach in Keepers of the Sea. Chapter 1. The Slow Fuse. Nizhnevartovsk, RSFSR. They moved swiftly, silently, with purpose, under a crystalline star-filled night in western Siberia. They were Muslims, though one could scarcely have known it from their speech, which was Russian, though inflected with the sing-song Azerbaijani accent that wrongly struck the senior members of the engineering staff as entertaining. The three of them had just completed a complex task in the truck and train yards, the opening of hundreds of loading valves. Ibrahim Tolkazi was their leader, though he was not in front. Rasul was in front, the massive former sergeant in the MVD who had already killed six men this cold night, three with a pistol hidden under his coat, and three with his hands alone. No one had heard them. An oil refinery is a noisy place. The bodies were left in shadows, and the three men entered Tolkazi's car for the next part of their task. Central Control was a modern three-story building fittingly in the center of the complex. For at least 5 kilometers in all directions stretched the cracking towers, storage tanks, catalytic chambers, and above all the thousands of kilometers of large-diameter pipe which made Nizhnevartovsk one of the world's largest refining complexes. The sky was lit at uneven intervals by waste gas fires, and the air was foul with the stink of petroleum distillates, aviation kerosene, gasoline, diesel fuel, benzene, nitrogen tetroxide for intercontinental missiles, lubricating oils of various grades, and complex petrochemicals identified only by their alphanumeric prefixes. They approached the brick-walled, windowless building in Tolkazi's personal Jiguli, and the engineer pulled into his reserved parking place, then walked alone to the door as his comrades crouched in the back seat. Inside the glass door, Ibrahim greeted the security guard, who smiled back, his hand outstretched for Tolkazi's security pass. The need for security here was quite real. But since it dated back over 40 years, no one took it more seriously than any of the pro forma bureaucratic complexities in the Soviet Union. The guard had been drinking, the only form of solace in this harsh, cold land. His eyes were not focusing, and his smile was too fixed. Tolkazi fumbled handing over his pass, and the guard lurched down to retrieve it. He never came back up. Tolkazi's pistol was the last thing the man felt, a cold circle at the base of his skull, and he died without knowing why, or even how. Ibrahim went behind the guard's desk to get the weapon the man had been only too happy to display for the engineers he'd protected. He lifted the body and moved it awkwardly to leave it slumped at the desk. Just another swing shift worker asleep at his post. then waved his comrades into the building. Rasul and Mohammed raced to the door. "It is time, my brothers." Tolkazi handed the AK-47 rifle and ammo belt to his taller friend. Rasul hefted the weapon briefly, checking to see that a round was chambered and the safety off. Then he slung the ammunition belt over his shoulder and snapped the bayonet in place before speaking for the first time that night. "Paradise awaits." Tolkazi composed himself, smoothed his hair, straightened his tie, and clipped the security pass to his white laboratory coat before leading his comrades up the 6 flights of stairs. Ordinary procedure dictated that to enter the master control room, one first had to be recognized by one of the operations staffers. And so it happened. Nikolai Barsov seemed surprised when he saw Tolkazi through the door's tiny window. "You're not on duty tonight, Isha." "One of my valves went bad this afternoon, and I forgot to check the repair status before I went off duty. You know the one, the auxiliary feed valve on kerosene number 8. If it's still down tomorrow, we'll have to reroute, and you know what that means." Barsov grunted agreement. "True enough, Isha." The middle-aged engineer thought Tolkazi liked the semi-Russian diminutive. He was badly mistaken. "Stand back while I open this damned hatch." The heavy steel door swung outward. Barsov hadn't been able to see Rasul and Mohammed before, and scarcely had time now. 3 7.62-millimeter rounds from the Kalashnikov exploded into his chest. The master control room contained a duty watch crew of 20, and looked much like the control center for a railroad or power plant. The high walls were cross-hatched with pipeline schematics, dotted with hundreds of lights to indicate which control valve was doing what. That was only the main display. Individual segments of the system were broken off onto separate status boards, mainly controlled by computer, but constantly monitored by half the duty engineers. The staff could not fail to note the sound of the 3 shots. But none of them were armed. With elegant patience, Rasul began to work his way across the room, using his Kalashnikov expertly and firing one round into each watch engineer. At first, they tried to run away, until they realized that Rasul was herding them into a corner like cattle, killing as he moved. 2 men bravely got on their command phones to summon a fast response team of KGB security troops. Rasul shot one of them at his post, but the other ducked around the line of command consoles to evade the gunfire and bolted for the door, where Tolkazi stood. It was Boris, Tolkazi saw, the party favorite, head of the local collective, the man who had befriended him, making him the special pet native of the Russian engineers. Ibrahim could remember every time this godless pig had patronized him, the savage foreigner imported to amuse his Russian masters. Tolkazi raised his pistol. "Isha!" the man screamed in terror and shock. Tolkazi shot him in the mouth, and hoped Boris didn't die too quickly to hear the contempt in his voice. "Infidel!" He was pleased that Rasul had not killed this one. His quiet friend could have all the rest. The other engineers screamed, through cups, chairs, manuals. There was nowhere left to run, no way around the swarthy, towering killer. Some held up their hands in useless supplication. Some even prayed aloud, but not to Allah, which might have saved them. The noise diminished as Rasul strode up to the bloody corner. He smiled as he shot the very last, knowing that this sweating infidel pig would serve him in paradise. He reloaded his rifle, then went back through the control room. He prodded each body with his bayonet, and again shot the 4 that showed some small sign of life. His face bore a grim content expression. At least 25 atheist pigs dead. 25 foreign invaders who would no longer stand between his people and their god. Truly, he had done Allah's work. The third man, Muhammad, was already at his own work as Rasul took his station at the top of the staircase. Working in the back of the room, he switched the room system's control mode from computer automatic to emergency manual, bypassing all of the automated safety systems. A methodical man, Ibrahim had planned and memorized every detail of his task over a period of months. But still he had a checklist in his pocket. He unfolded it now and set it next to his hand on the master supervisory control board. Tolkazi looked around at the status displays to orient himself, then paused. From his back pocket he took his most treasured personal possession, half of his grandfather's Koran, and opened it to a random page. It was a passage in the chapter of the spoils. His grandfather having been killed during the futile rebellions against Moscow, his father shamed by helpless subservience to the infidel state, Tolkazi had been seduced by Russian schoolteachers into joining their godless system. Others had trained him as an oil field engineer to work at the state's most valuable facility in Azerbaijan. Only then had the god of his fathers saved him, through the words of an uncle, an unregistered imam who had remained faithful to Allah and safeguarded this tattered fragment of the Koran that had accompanied one of Allah's own warriors. Tolkazi read the passage under his hand. And when the misbelievers plotted to keep thee prisoner, or kill thee, or drive thee forth, they plotted well. But God plotted too, and God is the best of plotters. Tolkazi smiled, certain that it was the final sign in a plan being executed by hands greater than his own. Serene and confident, he began to fulfill his destiny. First, the gasoline. He closed 16 control valves, the nearest of them 3 kilometers away, and opened 10, which rerouted 80 million liters of gasoline to gush out from a bank of truck-loading valves. The gasoline did not ignite at once. The 3 had left no pyrotechnic devices to explode this first of many disasters. Tolkazi reasoned that if he were truly doing the work of Allah, then his God would surely provide. And so he did. A small truck driving through the loading yard took a turn too fast, skidded on the splashing fuel, and slid broadside into a utility pole. It took only one spark, and already more fuel was spilling out into the train yards. With the master pipeline switches, Tolkazi had a special plan. He rapidly typed in a computer command, thanking Allah that Rasul was so skillful and had not damaged anything important with his rifle. The main pipeline from the nearby production field was 2 meters across, with many branch lines running to all of the production wells. The oil traveling in those pipes had its own mass and its own momentum supplied by pumping stations in the fields. Ibrahim's commands rapidly opened and closed valves. The pipeline ruptured in a dozen places, and the computer commands left the pumps on. The escaping light crude flowed across the production field, where only one more spark was needed to spread a holocaust before the winter wind, and another break occurred where the oil and gas pipelines crossed together over the river Ob. "The greenskins are here!" Rasul shouted a moment before the quick-response team of KGB border guards stormed up the staircase. A short burst from the Kalashnikov killed the first two, and the rest of the squad stopped cold behind a turn in the staircase as their young sergeant wondered what the hell they had walked into. Already automatic alarms were erupting around him in the control room. The master status board showed 4 growing fires whose borders were defined by blinking red lights. Tolkazi walked to the master computer and ripped out the tape spool that contained the digital control codes. The spares were in the vault downstairs, and the only men within 10 kilometers who knew its combination were in this room, dead. Mohammed was busily ripping out every telephone in the room. The whole building shook with the explosion of a gasoline storage tank 2 kilometers away. The crashing sound of a hand grenade announced another move by the KGB troops. Rasul returned fire, and the screams of dying men nearly equaled the ear-splitting fire alarm klaxons. Tolkazi hurried over to the corner. The floor there was slick with blood. He opened the door to the electrical fuse box, flipped the main circuit breaker, then fired his pistol into the box. Whoever tried to set things aright would also have to work in the dark. He was done. Ibrahim saw that his massive friend had been mortally hit in the chest by grenade fragments. He was wobbling, struggling to stay erect at the door, guarding his comrades to the last. "I take refuge in the Lord of the Worlds," Tolkazi called out defiantly to the security troops, who spoke not a word of Arabic. "The King of Men, the God of Men, from the evil of the Whispering Devil." The KGB sergeant leaped around the lower landing, and his first burst tore the rifle from Rasul's bloodless hands. Two hand grenades arched through the air as the sergeant disappeared back around the corner. There was no place and no reason to run. Mohammed and Ibrahim stood immobile in the doorway as the grenades bounced and skittered across the tiled floor. Around them the whole world seemed to be catching fire, and because of them the whole world really would.
Allahu Akbar!
Sunnyvale, California.
God Almighty!
The Chief Master Sergeant breathed. The fire, which had begun in the gasoline-diesel section of the refinery, had been sufficient to alert a strategic early-warning satellite in geosynchronous orbit 24,000 miles above the Indian Ocean. The signal was downlinked to a top-security U.S. Air Force post. The senior watch officer in the satellite control facility was an Air Force colonel. He turned to his senior technician. "Map it."
"Yes, sir."
The sergeant typed a command into his console, which told the satellite cameras to alter their sensitivity. With the flaring on the screen reduced, the satellite rapidly pinpointed the source of the thermal energy. A computer-controlled map on the screen adjacent to the visual display gave them an exact location reference.
"Sir, that's an oil refinery fire. Jeez, and it looks like a real pisser. Colonel, we got a big bird pass in 20 minutes, and the course track is within 120 kilometers.
"Uh-huh," the colonel nodded. He watched the screen closely to make sure that the heat source was not moving, his right hand lifting the gold phone to NORAD headquarters, Cheyenne Mountain, Colorado. "This is Argus Control. I have flash traffic for Sync NORAD."
"Wait one," said the first voice.
"This is Sync NORAD," said the second,
Commander-in-Chief of the North American Aerospace Defense Command.
"Sir, this is Colonel Burnett at Argus Control. We show a massive thermal energy reading at coordinates 60 degrees 50 minutes north, 76 degrees 40 minutes east. The site is listed as a POL refinery. The thermal source is not, repeat, not moving. We have a KH-11 pass close to the source in 20 minutes. My preliminary evaluation, General, is that we have a major oil field fire here."
"They're not doing a laser flash on your bird?" Sync NORAD asked.
There was always a possibility the Soviets were trying to play games with their satellite.
"Negative. The light source covers infrared and all of the visible spectrum, not, repeat, not monochromatic. We'll know more in a few minutes, sir. So far everything is consistent with a massive ground fire."
30 minutes later, they were sure. The KH-11 reconnaissance satellite came over the horizon close enough for all of its 8 television cameras to catalog the chaos. A side link transmitted the signal to a geosynchronous communications satellite, and Burnett was able to watch it all in real time. Live and in color. The fire had already engulfed half of the refinery complex and more than half of the nearby production field, with more burning crude oil spreading from the ruptured pipeline onto the River Ob. They were able to watch the fire spread, the flames carried rapidly before a 40-knot surface wind. Smoke obscured much of the area on visible light, but infrared sensors penetrated it,
to show many heat sources that could only be vast pools of oil products burning intensely on the ground. Burnett's sergeant was from East Texas, and had worked as a boy in the oil fields. He keyed up daylight photographs of the site and compared them with the adjacent visual display to determine what parts of the refinery had already ignited.
"Goddamn, Colonel!"
The sergeant shook his head reverently. He spoke with quiet expertise.
"The refinery? Well, it's gone, sir. That fire'll spread in front of that wind, and ain't no way in hell they'll stop it. The refinery's gone. Total loss. Burn maybe 3-4 days. Maybe a week, parts of it. And unless they find a way to stop it, looks like the production field is going to go too, sir. By next pass, sir, it'll all be burning, all those wellheads spilling, burning oil. Lord, I don't even think Red Adair would want any part of this job. Nothing left of the refinery.
Burnett watched a tape rerun of the Big Bird Pass. "It's their newest and biggest. Ought to put a dent in their POL production while they rebuild that from scratch. And once they get those field fires put out, they'll have to rearrange their gas and diesel production quite a bit. I'll say one thing for Ivan. When he has an industrial accident, he doesn't screw around. A major inconvenience for our Russian friend, Sergeant." This analysis was confirmed the next day by the CIA, and the day after that by the British and French security services. They were all wrong. Chapter 2. Odd Man In. Date, time, 1:31, 6:15. Copy 1 of 1. Soviet Fire, BC, Soviet Fire, BJT, 1809, FL. Disastrous fire reported in Soviet Nizhnevartovsk oil field, FL. EDS. Moved in advance for Wednesday PMS, FL, by William Blake, FC, AP Military Intelligence Writer. Washington, AP. The most serious oil field fire since the Mexico City disaster of 1984, or even the Texas City fire of 1947, sundered the darkness in the central region of the Soviet Union today, according to military and intelligence sources in Washington. The fire was detected by American National Technical Means, a term that generally denotes reconnaissance satellites operated by the Central Intelligence Agency. CIA sources declined comment on the incident. Sources in the Pentagon confirmed this report, noting that the energy given off by the fire was sufficient to cause a brief stir in the North American Aerospace Defense Command, which was concerned that the fire was a possible missile launch directed at the United States, or an attempt to blind American early warning satellites with a laser or other ground-based device. At no time, the source pointed out, was there any thought of increasing American alert levels, or of bringing American nuclear forces to higher states of readiness. "It was all over in less than 30 minutes," the source said. No confirmation was received from the Russian news agency TASS, but the Soviets rarely publish reports of such incidents. The fact that American officials referred to two epic industrial accidents is an indication that many fatalities might result from this major fire. Defense sources were unwilling to speculate on the possibility of civilian casualties. The city of Nizhnevartovsk is bordered by the petroleum complex. The Nizhnevartovsk oil production field accounts for roughly 31.3% of total Soviet crude oil, according to the American Petroleum Institute, and the adjacent newly built Nizhnevartovsk refinery for approximately 17.3% of petroleum distillate production. Fortunately for them, Donald Evans, a spokesman for the institute, explained, "Oil underground is pretty hard to burn, and you can expect the fire to burn itself out in a few days. The refinery, however, depending on how much of it was involved, could be a major expense. When they go, they usually go pretty big," Evans said. "But the Russians have sufficient excess refining capacity to take up the slack, especially with all the work they've been doing at their Moscow complex." Evans was unable to speculate on the cause of the fire, saying, "The climate could have something to do with it. We had a few problems in the Alaskan fields that took some careful work to solve. Beyond that, any refinery is a potential Disneyland for fire, and there simply is no substitute for intelligent, careful, well-trained crews to run them. This is the latest in a series of setbacks to the Soviet oil industry. It was admitted only last fall at the plenum of the Communist Party Central Committee that production goals in both the eastern Siberian fields had not entirely fulfilled earlier hopes. This seemingly mild statement is being seen in Western circles as a stinging indictment of the policies of now-departed Petroleum Industry Minister Zatijin, since replaced by Mikhail Sergeyev, former chief of the Leningrad Party apparatus, regarded as a rising star in the Soviet Party. A technocrat with a background of engineering and party work, Sergeyev's task of reorganizing the Soviet oil industry is seen as a task that could last years. APBA 0131, 0501 ESTFL, end of story. Moscow, RSFSR. Mikhail Eduardovich Sergeyev never had a chance to read the wire service report. Summoned from his official dacha in the birch forests surrounding Moscow, he'd flown at once to Nizhnevartovsk and stayed for only 10 hours before being recalled to make his report in Moscow. 3 months on the job, he thought, sitting in the empty forward cabin of the IL-86 airliner, and this has to happen. His two principal deputies, a pair of skilled young engineers, had been left behind and were trying even now to make sense of the chaos, to save what could be saved, as he reviewed his notes for the Politburo meeting later in the day. 300 men were known to have died fighting the fire, and, miraculously, fewer than 200 citizens in the city of Nizhnevartovsk. That was unfortunate, but not a matter of great significance except insofar as those trained men killed would eventually have to be replaced by other trained men drawn from the staffs of other large refineries. The refinery was almost totally destroyed. Reconstruction would take a minimum of 2 to 3 years, and would account for a sizable percentage of national steel pipe production, plus all the other specialty items unique to a facility of this type. 15,000 million rubles. And how much of the special equipment would have to be purchased from foreign sources? How much precious hard currency and gold would be wasted? And that was the good news. The bad news? The fire that had engulfed the production field had totally destroyed the well tops. Time to replace? At least 36 months. 36 months, Sergeyev reflected bleakly. If we can divert the drill rigs and crews to re-drill every damned well, and at the same time rebuild the EOR systems. For a minimum of 18 months, the Soviet Union will have an enormous shortfall in oil production. Probably more like 30 months. What will happen to our economy? He pulled a pad of lined paper from his briefcase and began to make some calculations. It was a 3-hour flight, and Sergeyev did not notice it was over until the pilot came back to announce they had landed. He looked with squinted eyes at the snow-covered landscape of Vnukovo II, the VIP-only airport outside of Moscow, and walked alone down the boarding stairs to a waiting Zeal limousine. The car sped off at once, without stopping at any of the security checkpoints. The shivering militia officers snapped to attention as the Zeal passed, then returned to the business of keeping warm in the sub-zero temperatures. The sun was bright, the sky clear but for some thin high clouds. Sergeyev looked vacantly out the windows, his mind mulling over figures he had already rechecked a half-dozen times. The Politburo was waiting for him, his KGB driver told him. Sergeyev had been a candidate, or non-voting member, of the Politburo for just 6 months, which meant that, along with his 8 other junior colleagues, he advised the 13 men who alone made the decisions that mattered in the Soviet Union. His portfolio was energy production and distribution. He had held that post since September, and was only beginning to establish his plan for a total reorganization of the 7 regional and all-union ministries that handled energy functions, and predictably spent most of their time battling one another, into a full department that reported directly to the Politburo and Party Secretariat, instead of having to work through the Council of Ministers bureaucracy. He briefly closed his eyes to thank God. There might be one, he reasoned, that his first recommendation, delivered only a month earlier, had concerned security and political reliability in many of the fields. He had specifically recommended further Russification of the largely foreign workforce. For this reason, he did not fear for his own career, which up to now had been an uninterrupted success story. He shrugged. The task he was about to face would decide his future in any case, and perhaps his country's. The Zeal proceeded down Leningradsky Prospect, which turned into Gorkogo, the limousine speeding through the center lane that policemen kept clear of traffic for the exclusive use of the Vlasti. They motored past the in-tourist hotel into Red Square, and finally approached the Kremlin Gate. Here the driver did stop for the security checks, 3 of them, conducted by KGB troops and soldiers of the Taman Guards. 5 minutes later the limousine pulled to the door of the Council of Ministers building, the sole modern structure in the fortress. The guards here knew Sergeyev by sight, and saluted crisply as they held open the door so that his exposure to the freezing temperatures would last but a brief span of seconds. The Politburo had been holding its meetings in this fourth-floor room for only a month, while their usual quarters in the old Arsenal building were undergoing a belated renovation. The older men grumbled at the loss of the old czarist comforts, but Sergeyev preferred the modernity. About time, he thought, that the men of the party surrounded themselves with the works of socialism instead of the moldy trappings of the Romanovs. The room was deathly quiet as he entered. Had this been in the Arsenal, the 54-year-old technocrat reflected, the atmosphere would have been altogether like a funeral, and there had been all too many of those. Slowly the party was running out of the old men who had survived Stalin's terror, and the current crop of members, all young men in their 50s or early 60s, was finally being heard. The guard was being changed. Too slowly, too damned slowly, for Sergeyev and his generation of party leaders, despite the new general secretary. The man was already a grandfather. It sometimes seemed to Sergeyev that by the time these old men were gone, he'd be one himself. But looking around this room now, he felt young enough. "Good day, comrades," Sergeyev said, handing his coat to an aide, who withdrew at once, closing the doors behind him. The other men moved at once to their seats. Sergeyev took his, halfway down the right side. The party general secretary brought the meeting to order. His voice was controlled and businesslike. "Comrade Sergeyev, you may begin your report. First, we wish to hear your explanation of exactly what happened." "Comrades, at approximately 2300 hours yesterday, Moscow time, 3 armed men entered the central control complex of the Nizhnevartovsk oil complex and committed a highly sophisticated act of sabotage." "Who are they?" the defense minister asked sharply. "We only have identification for 2 of them. One of the bandits was a staff electrician. The third," Sergeyev pulled the ID card from his pocket and tossed it on the table, "was senior engineer I.M. Tolkazi. He evidently used his expert knowledge of the control systems to initiate a massive fire which spread rapidly before high winds. A security team of 10 KGB border guards responded at once to the alarm. The one traitor still unidentified killed or wounded 5 of these with a rifle taken from the building guard, who was also shot. I must say, having interviewed the KGB sergeant," the lieutenant was killed leading his men, "that the border guards responded quickly and well. They killed the traitors within minutes, but were unable to prevent the complete destruction of the facility, both the refinery and production fields."
"And if the guards responded so fast, how then did they fail to prevent this act?"
the defense minister demanded angrily. He examined the photographic pass with palpable hatred in his eyes.
What was this black-ass Muslim doing there in the first place?
Comrade, work in the Siberian fields is arduous, and we have had serious difficulties in filling the posts we have there. My predecessor decided to conscript experienced oilfield workers from the Baku region to Siberia. This was madness. You will recall that my first recommendation last year was to change this policy.
We have noted it, Mikhail Eduardovich, the chairman said. Go on.
The guard post records all telephone and radio traffic. The response team was moving in under 2 minutes. Unfortunately, the guard post is located adjacent to the original control building. The current building was constructed 3 kilometers away when new computerized control equipment was obtained from the West 2 years ago. A new guard post was also supposed to have been built, and the proper materials were allocated for this purpose. It would appear that these building materials were misappropriated by the complex director and local party secretary for the purpose of building dachas on the river a few kilometers away. Both of these men have been arrested by my order for crimes against the state, Sergeyev reported matter-of-factly. There was no reaction around the table. By unspoken consensus, those two men were sentenced to death. The formalities would be worked out by the proper ministries. Sergeyev continued, I have already ordered greatly increased security at all petroleum sites. Also, on my orders, the families of the two known traitors have been arrested at their homes outside Baku and are being rigorously interrogated by state security, along with all who knew and worked with them. Before the border guards were able to kill the traitors, they were able to sabotage the oil field control systems in such a way as to create a massive conflagration. They were also able to wreck the control equipment so that even if the guard troops had been able to get a crew of engineers in to restore control, it is unlikely that anything would have been saved. The KGB troops were forced to evacuate the building, which was later consumed by the fire. There was nothing more they could have done. Sergeyev remembered the sergeant's badly burned face, the tears flowing down over the blisters, as he told his story.
The fire brigade? The general secretary asked.
More than half of them died fighting the fire, Sergeyev replied, along with over 100 citizens who joined the battle to save the complex. Truly, there is no blame to be assessed here, comrade. Once this bastard Tolkazi began his devil's work, it would have been as easy to control an earthquake. For the most part, the fire has been put out by now, due to the fact that most of the fuels stored in the refinery were consumed in about 5 hours, also because of the destruction of the wellheads in the oil field.
But how was this catastrophe possible? A senior member asked.
Sergeyev was surprised by the quiet mood in the room. Had they met and discussed this affair already? My report of December 20th described the dangers here. This room quite literally controlled the pumps and valves for over 100 square kilometers. The same is true of all of our large oil complexes. From the nerve center, a man familiar with control procedures could manipulate the various systems throughout the field at will, causing the entire complex quite simply to self-destruct. Tolkazi had such skill. He was an Azerbaijani chosen for special treatment for his intelligence and supposed loyalty, an honor student educated at Moscow State University, and a member in good standing of the local party. It would also seem that he was a religious fanatic capable of astounding treachery. All the people killed in the control room were friends of his, or so they thought. After 15 years in the party, a good salary, the professional respect of his comrades, even his own automobile, his last words were a shrill cry to Allah, Sergeyev said dryly. The reliability of people from that region cannot be accurately predicted, comrades. The defense minister nodded again.
So, what effect will this have on oil production?
Half the men at the table leaned forward to hear Sergeyev's answer. Comrades, we have lost 34% of our total crude oil production for a period of at least 1 year. Possibly as many as three. Sergeyev looked up from his notes to see the impassive faces cringe as though from a slap. It will be necessary to redrill every production well and finally reconstruct the pipelines from the fields to the refinery and elsewhere. The concurrent loss of the refinery is serious, but not an immediate concern, since the refinery can be rebuilt, and in any case represents less than a seventh of our total refining capacity. The major injury to our economy will come from the loss of our crude oil production. In real terms, due to the chemical makeup of the Nizhnevartovsk oil, the net total production loss understates the actual impact on our economy. Siberian oil is light, sweet crude, which means that it contains a disproportionately large amount of the most valuable fractions, those which we use to make gasoline, kerosene, and diesel fuel, for example. The net loss in these particular areas is 44% of our gasoline production, 48% of kerosene, and 50% of diesel. These figures are rough calculations I made on the flight back, but they should be accurate to within 2%. My staff will have more precise figures ready in a day or so.
Half, the general secretary asked quietly.
Correct, comrade, Sergeyev responded.
And how long to restore production?
Comrade General Secretary, if we bring in every drilling rig and operate them around the clock, my rough estimate is that we can begin to restore production in 12 months. Clearing the site of wreckage will take at least 3 months, and another 3 will be needed to relocate our equipment and commence drilling operations. Since we have exact information for well locations and depths, the usual element of uncertainty is not part of the equation. Within a year, that is 6 months after we commence the redrilling, we will begin to bring the production wells back on stream, and full restoration of the wells will be achieved within 2 more years. While all this is going on, we will need to replace the EOR equipment also.
And what might that be? Defense asked.
Enhanced oil recovery systems, Comrade Minister. Had these been relatively new wells, pressurized from underground gas, the fires might have lasted for weeks. As you know, comrades, these are wells from which a good deal of oil has already been extracted. To enhance production, we have been pumping water into the wells, which has the effect of forcing more oil out. It may also have had the effect of damaging the oil-bearing strata. This is something our geologists are even now attempting to evaluate. As it was, when power was lost, the force driving the oil from the ground was removed, and the fires in the production fields rapidly began to run out of fuel. They were, for the most part, dying out when my flight left for Moscow.
So, even 3 years from now, production may not be completely restored? The Minister of the Interior asked.
Correct, Comrade Minister. There is simply no scientific basis for making an estimate of total production. The situation we have here has never happened before, either in the West or the East. We can drill some test wells in the next 2 or 3 months that will give us some indications. The staff engineers I left behind are making arrangements to begin the process as quickly as possible with equipment already at the site.
Very well. The General Secretary nodded.
The next question is how long the country can operate on this basis.
Sergeyev went back to his notes.
Comrades, there is no denying that this is a disaster of unprecedented scale for our economy. The winter has drawn down our heavy oil inventories more than usual. Certain energy expenditures must remain relatively intact. Electrical power generation last year, for example, accounted for 38% of our oil products, far more than planned, due to past disappointments in coal and gas production, which we had expected to reduce oil demand. The coal industry will require at least 5 years to restore due to failures in modernization, and gas drilling operations are currently slowed by environmental conditions. For technical reasons, it is extremely hard to operate such equipment in extreme cold weather.
So make those lazy bastards on the drilling crews work harder, suggested the chief of the Moscow party.
It is not the workers, comrade. Sergeyev sighed. It is the machines. Cold temperature affects metal more than men. Tools and equipment break simply because they are brittle with cold. Weather conditions make resupply of spare parts to the camps more difficult. Marxism-Leninism cannot dictate the weather.
How difficult would it be to conceal the drilling operations? Defense asked.
Sergeyev was surprised.
Difficult? No, comrade minister, impossible. How can one conceal several hundred drilling rigs, each 20 to 40 meters high? One might as easily attempt to conceal Plesetsk's missile launch complexes.
Sergeyev noticed, for the first time, the glances being exchanged by defense and the general secretary.
Then we must reduce the consumption of oil by the electrical industry, the general secretary pronounced.
Comrades, allow me to give you some rough figures on the way in which we consume our oil products. Please understand that I am going from memory since the annual departmental report is in the process of formulation at this time. Last year, we produced 589 million tons of crude oil. This fell short of planned production by 32 million tons, and the amount actually produced was only possible due to the artificial measures that I have already discussed. Roughly half of that production was semi-refined into mazut, or heavy fuel oil, for use in electrical power plants, factory boilers, and the like. Most of this oil simply cannot be used otherwise, since we have only two refineries with the sophisticated catalytic cracking chambers needed to refine heavy oil into light distillate products. The fuels we produce serve our economy in many ways. As we have already seen, 38% goes for electrical and other forms of power generation, and fortunately, much of this is mazut. Of the lighter fuels, diesel, gasoline, and kerosene, agricultural production and the food industries, transportation of goods and commodities, public consumption and passenger transportation, and finally military uses, these alone absorbed more than half of last year's production. In other words, comrades, with the loss of the Nizhnevartovsk field, the end users I just mentioned account for more than we are able to produce, leaving nothing at all for metallurgy, heavy machinery, chemical and construction uses. Not to mention what we customarily export to our fraternal socialist allies in Eastern Europe and throughout the world. To answer your specific question, Comrade General Secretary, we can make, perhaps, a modest reduction in the use of light oils in electrical power usage. But even now we have a serious shortfall in electrical power production, resulting in occasional brownouts and complete power outages. Further cuts in power generation will adversely affect such crucial state activities as factory production and rail transport. You will recall that 3 years ago we experimented with altering the voltage of generated power to conserve fuels, and this resulted in damage to electric motors throughout the Donetsk industrial basin. What about coal and gas?
Comrade General Secretary, coal production is already 16% below planned output, and getting worse, which has caused conversion of many coal-fired boilers and power plants to oil. Moreover, the conversion of such facilities from oil back to coal is costly and time-consuming. Conversion to gas is a much more attractive and cheaper alternative that we have been vigorously pursuing. Gas production is also under plan, but it is improving. We had expected to exceed planned targets later this year. Here we must also account for the fact that much of our gas goes to Western Europe. It is from this that we gain Western currency with which to purchase foreign oil and, of course, foreign grain. The Politburo member in charge of agriculture winced at this reference. How many men, Sergeyev wondered, had been done in by their inability to make the Soviet agricultural industry perform?
not the current General Secretary, of course, who had somehow managed to advance despite his failures there. But good Marxists weren't supposed to believe in miracles. His elevation to the titular chairmanship had had its own price, one which Sergeyev was only beginning to understand.
So, what is your solution, Mikhail Eduardovich? The defense minister inquired with unsettling solicitude.
Comrades, we must bear this burden as best we can, improving efficiency at every level of our economy. Sergeyev didn't bother talking about increasing imports of oil. The shortfall, he had explained, would result in more than a 30-fold increase in imports, and hard currency reserves would scarcely allow a doubling of foreign oil purchases. We will need to increase production and quality control at the barricade drilling rig factory in Volgograd, and to purchase more drilling equipment from the West, so that we can expand exploration and exploitation of known fields. And we need to expand our construction of nuclear reactor plants. To conserve what production we do have, we can restrict supplies available to trucks and personal automobiles. There is much waste in this sector, as we all know, perhaps as much as a third of total usage. We can temporarily reduce the amount of fuel consumed by the military, and perhaps also divert some heavy machine production from military hardware to necessary industrial areas. We face 3 very hard years, but only 3, Sergeyev summarized on an upbeat note.
"Comrade, your experience in foreign and defense areas is slim, no?" the defense minister asked.
"I have never pretended otherwise, comrade minister," Sergeyev answered warily.
"Then I will tell you why this situation is unacceptable. If we do what you suggest, the West will learn of our crisis. Increased purchases of oil production equipment and unconcealable signs of activity at Nizhnevartovsk will demonstrate to them all too clearly what is happening here. That will make us vulnerable in their eyes. Such vulnerability will be exploited. And at the same time," he pounded his fist on the heavy oak table, "you propose reducing the fuel available to the forces who defend us against the West."
"Comrade Defense Minister, I am an engineer, not a soldier. You asked me for a technical evaluation, and I gave it." Sergeyev kept his voice reasonable. "This situation is very serious, but it does not, for example, affect our strategic rocket forces. Cannot they alone shield us against the imperialists during our recovery period?" "Why else had they been built?" Sergeyev asked himself. "All that money sunk into unproductive holes. Wasn't it enough to be able to kill the West 10 times over? Why 20 times? And now this wasn't enough?"
"And it has not occurred to you that the West will not allow us to purchase what we need?" the party theoretician asked.
"When have the capitalists refused to sell us? When have the capitalists had such a weapon to use against us?" the General Secretary observed. "For the first time the West has the ability to strangle us in a single year. What if now they also prevent our purchase of grain?"
Sergeyev hadn't considered that. With yet another disappointing grain harvest, the 7th out of the last 11 years, the Soviet Union needed to make massive purchases of wheat. And this year, America and Canada were the only reliable sources. Bad weather in the southern hemisphere had damaged Argentina's harvest, and, to a lesser extent, Australia's, while the U.S. and Canada had enjoyed their customary record crops. Negotiations were even now underway in Washington and Ottawa to secure such a purchase, and the Americans were making no trouble at all, except that the high value of the dollar made their grain disproportionately expensive. But that grain would take months to ship. How easy would it be, Sergeyev wondered, for technical difficulties in the grain ports of New Orleans and Baltimore to slow, or even stop, shipments entirely at a crucial moment?
He looked around the table. 22 men, of whom only 13 really decided matters, and one of those was missing, were silently contemplating the prospect of over 250 million Soviet workers and peasants, all hungry and in the dark, at the same time that the troops of the Red Army, the Ministry of the Interior, and the KGB found their own fuel supplies, and, because of it, their training and mobility restricted. The men of the Politburo were among the most powerful in the world, far more so than any of their Western counterparts. They answered to no one, not the Central Committee of the Communist Party, not the Supreme Soviet, certainly not the people of their nation. These men had not walked on the streets of Moscow for years, but been whisked by chauffeured, handmade cars to and from their luxury apartments within Moscow, or to their ceremonial dachas outside the city. They shopped, if at all, in guarded stores restricted to the elite, were served by doctors in clinics established only for the elite. Because of all this, these men regarded themselves as masters of their destiny. It was only now beginning to strike them that, like all men, they too were subject to a fate which their immense personal power merely made all the more intractable. Around them was a country whose citizens were poorly fed and poorly housed, whose only abundant commodities were the painted signs and slogans praising Soviet progress and solidarity. Some of the men at this table actually believed those slogans, Sergeyev knew. Sometimes he still did, mainly in homage to his idealistic youth. But Soviet progress had not fed their nation. And how long would Soviet solidarity endure in the hearts of people hungry, cold, in the dark? Would they be proud of the missiles in the Siberian forests then? Of the thousands of tanks and guns produced every year? Would they then look to the sky that held a Salyut space station and feel inspired? Or would they wonder what kind of food was being eaten by that elite? Less than a year before, Sergeyev had been a regional party chieftain. And in Leningrad, he had been careful to listen to his own staff people's description of the jokes and grumblings in the lines which people endured for two loaves of bread, or toothpaste, or shoes. Detached even then from the harsher realities of life in the Soviet Union, he had often wondered if one day the burden of the ordinary worker would become too heavy to endure. How would he have known then? How would he know now? Would the older men here ever know? Narod, they called it. A masculine noun that was nonetheless raped in every sense. The masses, the faceless collection of men and women who toiled every day in Moscow and throughout the nation in factories and on collective farms, their thoughts hidden behind unsmiling masks. The members of the Politburo told themselves that these workers and peasants did not grudge their leaders the luxuries that accompanied responsibility. After all, life in the country had improved in measurable terms. That was the compact. But the compact was about to be broken. What might happen then? Nicholas II had not known. These men did. The defense minister broke the silence. We must obtain more oil. It is as simple as that. The alternative is a crippled economy, hungry citizens, and reduced defense capacity, the consequences of which are not acceptable.
We cannot purchase oil, a candidate member pointed out.
Then we must take it. Fort Meade, Maryland. Bob Toland frowned at his spice cake. I shouldn't be eating dessert, the intelligence analyst reminded himself. But the National Security Agency commissary served this only once a week, and spice cake was his favorite. And it was only about 200 calories. That was all. An extra 5 minutes on the exercise bike when he got home.
What did you think of that article in the paper, Bob? A co-worker asked. The oil field thing? Toland rechecked the man's security badge. He wasn't cleared for satellite intelligence. Sounds like they had themselves quite a fire. You didn't see anything